Good afternoon. We're opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today is February 10th, 2015. We're going to be opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5502, Department of Administrative Services. Just so folks know, today I'll be holding the gavel, and then for the next 2 days, my Senate co-chair will be holding the gavel as I need to be out of here at a in-district commitment on Thursday. Want to just share with the committee, it's really important that we ask lots of good questions. But I want to make sure we also understand that our questions need to be related to the budget, and budget questions are fair. And so I'd encourage that. But let's keep our comments to the budget. So, with that said, Paul, why don't you get us started?
Sure. Mr. Chairman of the committee, again, you have Senate Bill 5502 is the budget bill for Department of Administrative Services, and you have the director, Michael Jordan, and acting deputy director, Barry Pack, here to talk to you.
Perfect. Gentlemen.
I might just note, too, that for tomorrow, there is a work session and public hearing scheduled on House Bill 2177. That is the first thing on the agenda for tomorrow's meeting.
All righty. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. And with me is Barry Pack. We have some bit of presentation that we didn't quite get to yesterday. We're going to complete that, and then we'll move on to a couple of our service divisions, the Enterprise HR Services, Human Resource Services, and Enterprise Goods and Services. With that, I'm going to let Barry kick off these audit slides, and we'll get moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer with the Department of Administrative Services. And we did leave off at the status of audit findings from yesterday. This first slide is a compilation of both findings from Secretary of State audits as well as our own internal auditor recommendations. For the reporting period of January 1st, 2013 through the end of the 2014 fiscal year, we have had no new audits since the end of the fiscal 14 year to report on. So that's why we're limiting our report to you today on that period of time, although there are some audits underway from the Secretary of State that will be coming out in the months ahead. There were a total of 96 audit recommendations in that period of time, 32 from the Secretary of State, 64 from our own internal auditor, and at this point in time, 84% of those have been completed or are no longer applicable because the program has changed. Of the outstanding recommendations, most are in the works. Some of them were held up because of a change in leadership within a particular division, and then there are a number of findings as it relates to our cash handling and some finance and accounting recommendations where changes in processes will address multiple recommendations, but they take a little bit longer to implement. So they're underway, but they're not quite there yet, but we'll see that number bounce up a little bit more. Focusing in on the Secretary of State audits, this first audit was around agency contracting with former employees. This was not a DAS audit. This was an audit of all agencies, but the Secretary of State, at Mr. Jordan's request, and probably for interest of full disclosure, I was Deputy Secretary of State when all of these audits were released, and so I signed off on them. So I should just put, there's no conflict of interest, but just to put it on the record. At Mr. Jordan's request, this audit looked at agency contracting through the Department of Administrative Services, so contracts that our procurement service people let to other former employees for agencies to hire them back in a short-term, limited-duration, usually role. There were no specific recommendations in the audit. The audit found that agencies were appropriately contracting with these former employees. There were a number of suggestions around record keeping and process improvements that were included in the audit, which we have agreed with and have implemented. In March of that year was a computer controls review. This is a fairly regular audit that the Secretary of State does out at the Enterprise Technology Services, the data center. Had two principal recommendations in here: completing and testing disaster recovery plans, and making sure that we maintain an accurate listing of all media tapes and that those tapes are reviewed we have implemented all of those recommendations.
Representative Coleman.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Steiner. Howard Hayward. Yes, and I'll just get this burr from underneath my saddle right now, but when agencies come before us and say, well, this position wasn't filled by such and such a time, I used to be a school principal. We did not have an option not to get something filled on time. We are about government efficiency and serving our public, and it disturbs me when we continue to hear something's posted. And I understand in the recession, some jobs were held off, you know, to be filled for the intention of making sure we could do our budget. But I just don't know. I don't need an answer. It's just a pet peeve. When you say it's some positions aren't filled, then I think, oh, our public's not being served. So that's it. I won't pick on it anymore.
It's a good reminder.
Thank you. So both of these recommendations have been completed. In April, it's a busy 2012 was a busy year. The Secretary of State released an audit on strategies to better address federal level of effort requirements. And these are requirements around how agencies maintain level of effort over biennia between budget cycles from federally funded programs. The recommendation was to require programs to distinctly identify those funding sources and then for us to convene key staff to figure out ways that we might manage the general fund component of those federal funds, the matching piece as it relates to the federal funds that are used in these programs. So our budget instructions were strengthened for this budget cycle to make sure that level of distinction between those monies is appropriately established. And then our budget staff have been meeting regularly with agencies to discuss the broader question around are there better ways to leverage the general fund component in this area. There are no packages requested in our current budget to address any of these findings because we were able to do them with existing resources. We do have a package in the Enterprise Technology Service that is related to security from prior audits, but those were from their ongoing security efforts that were identified biennia or so ago.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I did not start trying to read ahead to see if you're going to address what I'm going to ask about. This, seeing this one about level of effort and being able to meet federal requirements reminds me of something else I had been concerned about in a previous session that I don't know if there was a specific audit finding about this. There doesn't seem to be a way through our current financial tracking mechanisms through budget management or whatever to see in one place with one appropriate query what are all the federal grants we've received.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
And we had no list of all the properties we own and rent. There, you know, not a single source. The reason I ask about this is I was on a subcommittee in the last session when someone came to us in the 11th hour. It was, as I recall, it must have been like the month of. Well, if it was the full session, it would have been, let's say, maybe in May. It was really when the committee would have been winding down in the 11th hour of doing business as a legislature. Oh, will you please approve something? It had to do with extending the terms for being able to receive federal funds and expend them. What had happened is we had received approval for something. We had just never spent the money and done it. Someone literally just lost track of this thing. And I thought, well, gee, you know, I have an automated calendar and I can put reminders in there. This is not new technology. A reminder that, oh, I've got a deadline coming up, or remind me a week in advance or a month in advance of something. And I said, do we have a system on things like grants where a report will be due or money has to be expended by a certain date? Do we not have just some automated system to remind us of these benchmark times? Well, we didn't even have them all listed, much less have a system to do this. So has this been identified as something to improve in our either budget or financial systems? But it would have to be statewide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I remember this discussion from last year, 2 years ago, whenever it was. Our current financial systems don't have that capability. You'll hear us say that periodically throughout the time we're with you. This system doesn't have that functionality. They're all old. They all, you know, they were evolved in a period of time that, you know, is 20 years ago. It doesn't follow where we are today. We have a plan we'll be talking to you about how to replace some of those systems, and a lot of that reporting capability and tracking capability should be part of a modern system, but it's going to take us a little bit of time.
Senator Johnson.
I can't believe I've sat here as long as I have and hadn't thought about what a great idea you just came
that
up with.
Good.
That's fabulous.
A really good idea.
The other thing that would be interesting to know, because we operate on a committee system, and by necessity only certain people have access to certain information, it would be lovely, as you're putting together a tracking system, to figure out what ongoing state obligation there is. We hear it in Ways and Means, where somebody says no state funding required. Well, it depends how you ask the question. No state funding required in this portion of this biennium, but you got to come up with $20 bazillion next biennium. It would be nice to see what our continuing obligation is, a fiscal obligation. And then the biggie is, what's the efficacy? We accept these federal grants. Some of them have obligations, new colleagues. Some of them don't. And we do a certain thing that's required by the federal grant. I don't know how well we as a body track the outcome. Was a problem solved? Was it efficacious? Did we get a good return? The accumulation of federal money in and of itself seems to become a goal. I think we lose track of monitoring what bang we got for the federal buck.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I rarely do this, but I'll just make a comment on what the Senator just said. I agree with everything you said. The one thing I would point out is that sometimes negative results are useful results as well. If we attempt a pilot program, we do it well, and it doesn't work, that's just as important.
Oh, I can concur.
I just want to clarify,
completely.
Right? Because it's important. If we're trying a pilot program, we got to design them well, and we got to make sure that those results are known so that other people say, okay, well, why didn't it work? And so, anyway, but otherwise, I completely agree with you, Senator. Okay.
Hey, Representative Kalm.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And this is for Paul. As we're talking about these things, because I was thinking about how these comments come out, particularly on e-board or in the full, and many of our colleagues don't have the information we have when we're doing our decision-making. And maybe, you know, when our co-chairs have nothing better to do. But think about a little bit more better communication plan to the whole body. They'll love me for that.
Let's continue.
The next piece that we wanted to conclude from yesterday was the report on implementation of House Bill 4131. This is the bill that passed, I think, in 2012, requiring agencies to move towards a ratio of 11 employees to supervisor. When that law passed in 2012, DAS was at one supervisor to every 7 employees. Since then, we've annually made progress. We're now at 1 to 10, and we are in the planning stages of taking a look at what it will take to get to 1 to 11. I will tell you that DAS's experience is probably similar to many other agencies, and as they report to you, you may hear again that it gets harder and harder the further up you go, and you start facing some difficult choices to meet that ratio. But we are at 1 to 10, and we are in the planning stages for the next step.
Good question.
And with that, Mr. Jordan.
So moving to today's presentation, we are going to speak with you today, as I said before, about some of our service delivery divisions, Enterprise Human Resources and Enterprise Goods and Services. I would like to take a couple of minutes before that to talk a little more in depth about a subject that was at least broached yesterday, and that's this concept that we've come up with regarding customer utility boards. Each of the divisions you see there has their own customer utility board, actually acting a bit like a board of directors for the enterprise. There are currently 42 CUB members active on these four committees. They represent 34 executive branch agencies, the judicial branch of state government, and two local government entities. We bring them together, the next slide, to really perform four major functions. They do a lot of interacting, as we mentioned yesterday, with the agency and the service divisions, but really four big things. They not only approve rates as presented to them, but they work with the division to develop the rate methodology. So they actually work on the nuts and bolts of what the methodology will be and how those costs would get allocated to users of the service across the different customer bases, and then ultimately adopt those rates. Just to give particularly the new members a context for this operation, we are now entering the 15-17 biennium. We're budgeting for that biennium, which will end on June 30 of 17. The Cubs started rate development in the summer of 13. They develop those rates so that they can be incorporated into the budget instructions that go to agencies in the early spring of 14. Those budgets, agency request budgets, are due to the governor the end of August of 14. The governor's budget is due to the legislature December of 14, and you are just now beginning to deliberate on that budget, which will be good until the middle of 17. So you get a four, and right after you finish and we start on that biennium, we will start working again on the rate schedule for the next biennium. So I just want to give you a sense of scale. I believe that's way too much work and way too crazy making for all of state government. But we have yet to figure out a way to adjust that whole process so it isn't so labor intensive. And we're working on that, but it's a big shift for us to move away from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jordan, I apologize for not telling you ahead of time that I was going to ask you this question, but you brought this up.
I opened the door.
You did open the door. Yes, exactly, counsel. yesterday in the Senate Health Committee, Policy Committee, we heard from the Oregon Medical Board with their bill to become a semi-independent agency. Mm-hmm. And they have a range of reasons for wanting to do that, and there are pros and cons. But one of the arguments that they keep making is that the process of getting some of their core services through DAS is cumbersome at best, and time and labor intensive, as you alluded to. And you know, it's just like you go in to apply to get something printed, and it takes twice as long as it would if you were out in the commercial market. I don't know how the costs compare. But I'm interested in your thoughts about what role the Cubs can play in resolving these issues, because if one of the reasons we have boards like the OMB wanting to get out is because of this, then we're going to lose the economies of scale. I mean, not that the OMB is huge. It's a $10 million agency that gets all its fees from licenses. It's all its revenue from licenses. But regardless, I think we have to be thinking about these questions.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I couldn't agree more. The potential here is roughly 150 or so, 160 or so customers between agencies and boards and commissions that that need these services, okay? And you'll see in the presentation a little later, many of our services, we have a client base within state government of 30 to 40 agencies, leaving a market that is quite a bit larger than our service delivery. Now, some of those are very large agencies that serve themselves, mm-hmm. Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, ODOT, et cetera. But the others choose one way or another. We've actually attempted to set up a bit of a market scheme here so that people can transparently see the costs and can, to the degree possible, modulate the level of service they're getting from us. But if they choose to get service in other ways, they're free to do that. And for us, I think that that creates a dynamic that forces us to get more efficient if we're going to continue to deliver these services. And I think we're making some progress on those. However, I want a big caveat here. So we're going to talk about enterprise human resource services in a few minutes. That's basic human resource service, right? We've got about 30-some client agencies, I think.
20.
Excuse me, 20 in HR services. As I mentioned, the big kids do their own work, right? They've got their own HR departments. But we have probably scores of little folks out there that have no specific HR expertise on staff, and they don't get it from us. I will tell you, I get to write the check from the risk pool when they screw up an HR issue. Yep. So we've got some issues facing the big organization regarding both cost and how we deliver service, but also what's our level of threshold for risk and where do those lines meet. And so it's a complex environment that you've alluded to, and I just wanted to let the committee know that we're looking at all those things.
So, Madam Co-Chair, you have a follow-up, and then I'll go to Sandra Johnson.
Thank you. Really quick. Yeah, I get exactly what you're saying, and I think the distinction is services that are readily available in the commercial market, printing,
right,
copying,
commodity type services,
as opposed to policy and intellectual property, if you will, services, which HR, which I would kind of characterize HR as being in that latter group. And I personally believe very strongly that it's in the state's best interest to, as you pointed out yesterday, and I asked about dissemination of policy throughout the agencies. When it comes to things like HR. And I think those are two very different kinds of things. And I don't have a problem with the legislature telling state agencies, you've got to be confident, if you're not directly using DAS HR services, you've got to be confident that you are completely up to date on the policies because you represent the state. And we have policies and we have best practices. So I think they're really two separate things. And I'm glad that you brought that up because they are two entirely separate problems from my perspective.
Okay, getting back to the Cubs, the other thing we ask them to do, I mentioned this yesterday, is they enter into and work with the service providers in our shop to develop service level agreements. Those service level agreements include the entire service catalog of services from that enterprise. They include base services. They include optional services that agencies have a choice of which to use or not, and the costs of those. They also, within those service level agreements, identify metrics, how they measure whether the service is being delivered at the level that's in the agreement, and they also set targets for those metrics. They're also charged with monitoring and reviewing. Each of these divisions produces a report quarterly to the Cub for their review on those metrics and those service level targets, and the Cubs review them. Third, we ask them to review business plans and annual financial statements. We're just getting into the cycle of producing and reviewing those now for Cubs, and so they'll be approaching those as we enter the next budget cycle and going over it. What do I mean by business plans, strategic direction, goals, objectives, capital investments that the agency may want to be making, new or existing projects that go to service levels or efficiency of those operations. So the Cubs review those periodically. And then last, we expect them to play a role. Oh, excuse
me. Let me ask a question on that really quick. Can you remind me of the Cubs? My understanding were they were the directors of. Help me understand the membership of the Cubs.
Sure. They have various members that represent, try to represent the breadth of the customer base. So big agencies, small agencies, they are usually business level folks. So you're going to hear from a couple of folks today, a deputy director.
So where I'm going with my question is, do they have the skills to actually review a financial statement? It's one thing to read a financial statement. It's another thing to understand a financial statement.
Well, it's another thing to see the financial statements that we produce in government, Mr. Chair.
Help me understand.
They're not exactly a P&L from a business, but they're similar. You know, we're talking about expenses and revenues, those kinds of things, and they tend to look, and they're divided up by sections, and so people can see personnel costs and equipment and all of those kinds of things in the financial statements.
So within the in the Cub team, there, mm-hmm. there's folks who have those expertises.
Yes.
So
yes.
While there might be others who may not, there's folks who do.
Yes.
That's what I need.
Absolutely.
Here. Thank you.
Absolutely. And we bring them together also to be subject matter experts for us to help with those things. So the last piece in the – I'm sorry. Is there a question?
Senator Whitsitt, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Okay.
On the – when you talk about revenue
mm-hmm.
on a government statement, is it common practice to include both what I would call current revenues, revenues that are being generated as you're going along, and money that is you're able to spend because you borrowed it, and to put that into the same revenue pot?
We don't include borrowing as operational revenue, Senator. So, you know, our borrowing
do you ever
is
look
restricted
at the,
to capital
do you,
investments.
Do you ever look at the Department of Transportation budget?
No, sir. I don't look at the Department of Transportation budget, but I know other people who do.
We should get together.
Okay.
Absolutely. That sounds really scary to me.
Let's continue.
So the last piece that we expect of Cubs is that they play a role in conflict resolution or complaint resolution from clients to the organization. We hope that most complaints from customers are solved immediately at the lowest level of the organization possible. But if they can't be, they could elevate to the Cub, and they would look at trying to resolve that or referring them on to people like myself who would ultimately resolve them. So those are the things we expect of the Cub as a group and their responsibilities. And then individually, we mentioned this briefly yesterday, we ask them to come to these meetings not necessarily just representing their own agency. Certainly their agency has an interest in this. They pay our fees just like everybody else. But we really ask them to think about customers as a class and how can all of state government benefit from the way we provide these services. So we ask them to do that. Secondly, as I mentioned before, they do furnish expertise for us. So they bring a broad range of experience and expertise to advise the agency on how to produce better services. Prioritizing.
Question
for
Representative Nathanson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't necessarily need a long response or any response, but it occurs to me when I think about your customers mm-hmm. and, you know, big agencies, small agencies, mm-hmm. different kinds of missions, there's also another thing that has occurred to me. We have some agencies that they do all their business out of one shop. They're located in one space, Salem, Portland, or maybe it's even a board or a commission.
Mm-hmm.
It could either be a big agency or a small agency. Seems like the issues, some of the issues that have to do with services that confront some of our agencies are those with satellites at various locations around the state.
Mm-hmm.
DHS has lots of locations around the state. State police does. That's a different kind of the complexity of mm-hmm. issues for them is just substantially different.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, you're correct. Obviously, many of the agencies that have lots of satellite offices across the state are the bigger agencies. They supply many of their own services that we're talking about here within themselves. Not all, but some. So we supply, for instance, a lot of network service to large okay. agencies that have a lot of satellite offices out of enterprise technology services, but certainly not their HR. Those are supplied by the bigger agencies. Things that are kind of stuff, commodity stuff, often they buy those, but they do it off of statewide price agreements that are administered by us at Enterprise Goods and Services, which we'll talk about a little later. So it's a real mix, but you're right, that geographic nature of offices can make it more complex. And so back to this, other things we really look forward to getting from members on Cubs is not only their expertise, but helping us prioritize limited resources. So, you know, it would be great if we could do everything that everybody wanted all the time. That's not realistic. And so having our customers work with us on prioritization of service, what's most important? What if we had to get rid of something, what would it be? So that's a big thing we hope from them. And then lastly, and we're just starting to get to this place, I think, in this maturation of the relationship, push us to innovate. Don't just let us keep doing things over and over and over again and continue to get the same complaints or continue to complain about the same things. Let's work and push to try and change the nature of the way we deliver service. Try to get ahead of curves and innovate on things. So those are the things we kind of expect out of individuals on the Cubs.
So let me ask a 101 question. We keep referring to agencies and departments as customers.
Mm-hmm.
What do agencies and customers refer to you as?
I thought I did.
Well, there are a lot of words that I can't repeat.
I understand what you're saying, but how do they?
Well,
what are they calling you,
Mr. Chairman? Generally speaking, I think they refer to us as a service provider, as a
service
vendor,
provider.
You know, and they look at us, as we've spoken here already, sometimes in a competitive environment. We charge a certain amount for a certain service. Some agencies say, you know, I can get that service for less, or I don't need that service. And so they see us as a vendor in very many ways. Now, we talked yesterday about another hat we hold, which is leader and convener in the organization. But in today's venue, talking about service delivery, I think they view us generally as a vendor.
It's a simple question, but I really appreciate that. Yeah. That helps me a lot.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. And so we have a couple of folks here I'd like you to hear from. These are two folks who are active on the Cubs. We have Carrie Nelson from the Department of Environmental Quality, who is their Central Services Administrator. She's the Vice Chair of the Human Resources Cub. And Clyde Psyche, who's the Director of Central Services at ODOT, he chairs the Technology Services Cub, with your permission.
Really, Representative Hurd, and then we'll move
sure.
that direction.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jordan, I've been doing some catching up reading last night. I was reading The Oregonian, and it involved this new innovation, I guess, in state government called the Genuine Progress Indicator, the GPI. Forgive me, I'm a freshman, so I'm just trying to understand stuff here. When did you first become aware of the GPI, and who first made you aware of it?
Mr. Chairman? Representative Hurd, I started talking about this with the governor, I would say, in 2000. Mm-hmm. We were both on the progress board together, and he was the chair. I was a new member. If you're not familiar with the progress board, it had a set of benchmarks that were divided into three major categories: economic, environmental, and community benchmarks. They weren't necessarily being used in a comprehensive way at that time, and we talked about how you could either take suites of these indicators and try to paint a more comprehensive picture about the costs and benefits of certain kinds of policies or investments. So that's the earliest I remember talking about something like the genuine progress indicator that you refer to. That tool, if you will, is very similar to those conversations that we were having back in those days.
Follow up. Do you believe the GPI is an accurate and objective economic indicator?
I believe it is a more comprehensive view of the costs and benefits of policy decisions and investments. I would not call it completely objective. It depends entirely on the indicators you choose and how you weight them to get the index. There are ways to do what we call subaccounts, where you choose certain suites of indicators for certain kinds of policy decisions or investments. Again, the ones you choose and the way you weight them can be subjective, and so but it's a tool.
Thank you.
You bet. If it's with your permission, I'd ask the thank you.
Welcome. We're glad
Thank
you're
you.
Here.
I'm a little shorter than Mr. Patrick. Chair Smith, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Carrie Nelson, and I'm the administrator at Department of Environmental Quality for Central Services. I do serve as the vice chair for the Human Resources Customer Utility Board, and I was one of the inaugural members on this board, and so I've had a chance to see it grow and develop with time. We oversee a fairly diverse portfolio. Some of the services all state agencies use, such as our electronic recruitment system. Some agencies can actually subscribe to, such as iLearn, which is our electronic learning management system. And others, as Mr. Jordan mentioned, are HR client services, where small agencies, boards, and commissions who don't have their own HR department actually contract with DAS, the service provider, to provide those basic services. Our membership is very broad. Some of the smaller agencies and boards on our particular CUB, our Commission for the Blind, as well as Department of Aviation, up to medium-sized agencies such as mine, to larger agencies such as Department of Corrections and ODOT. I'm going to touch on three areas that Mr. Jordan talked about, and those are the service level agreements, or SLAs, rate setting, and then dispute resolution. And I'm going to do dispute resolution first because our CUB has not had a complaint that couldn't be resolved at a local level and come up to us. So I don't know exactly what that means, but I take it as good news. For our service level agreement, what we needed to do, and all the CUBs had to do this, is really define what services are we going to provide, and essentially a catalog or menu of services. And we had to be very clear as to what those were. And so we could set expectations of what a client could get if they subscribed to the service, as well as what their performance standards would be for DAS to perform to. And our particular CUB approached that process from using subcommittee. So we actually got what I would call representation from small, medium, and large, essentially sort of mirroring the larger CUB, and had those work on subcommittees and then come back to the CUB to talk about what those services looked like. We did the same with rate setting. And that's where things got a little more interesting. Because it's one thing to describe a service, it's a little different to all of a sudden put a specific dollar tag to it, particularly when you're used to getting more of a general assessment. So I'll give an example of how we went through one of those, which would be on the iLearn program that I mentioned earlier, the electronic learning management system. When we first did that, there are several ways that you could calculate this. And at first I was thinking, what do you mean several ways? But do you do it on just each agency base cost? And then how about many users? Or do you look at active users? Maybe there's a population of that agency that doesn't actually access the system. How about if you develop training and you make it available to the enterprise, thus dropping costs overall? How do you factor that in? So we actually ran through several different rate models to come up with one that was equitable across the various agencies and commissions, from very small to very large. And for all the different service level, service items in the service level agreement, after we got done, rolled them all together, DAS ran what our individual agency numbers would be based on the new methodology, and it really showed what I would call some sore thumbs, things that either didn't make sense because the rates dropped too low, or they were out of proportion because the rates went up too high. So our subcommittees went back to the drawing board and worked with that numbers and tried to get it down again to where things were more normalized.
So we have a question really quick. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ms. Nelson, this is really illuminating for me, and I appreciate you explaining it so clearly. And your point about what happens if there's one agency that doesn't use a certain component, I think you can generalize that to pretty much any infrastructure service, which is essentially what DAS does, is provide infrastructure services. And I'm interested to know for your CUB whether you think that those things sort of equalize out. Like, there are certain things that some agencies service A, agency X uses, but agency Y doesn't, but service B, agency Y uses, and agency X doesn't, and does it equalize out over time, and therefore they subsidize each other, or do you think that there are packages of things that certain agencies use more and other agencies use other packages? I don't know if that's exactly where you can tie this, but I'm thinking about that in the rate setting process and how we think about pretty much any infrastructure service, regardless of what level of government it's provided at, whether it's provided to individual citizens or to other agencies.
Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I can't give you a precise answer. I can tell you what I believe to be the fact based on our group. It's more in size of agency.
Okay.
And again, I would say most of the medium to large size agencies all access the electronic recruiting system.
Sure.
In terms of iLearn, it became an economy of scale. And I know, for instance, that ODOT just recently has gone down the path to join that. And so when you have, when some of the times in-house, you've got your own system or process that works, but then as the enterprise grows, you see opportunity to connect to that and become more efficient. Smaller agencies far more dependent either on DAS as the service provider or at times other agencies that they might be co-located with. So I don't know if that's entirely responsive to your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Throughout the process, again, although we... I believe the CUB and our subgroups had very broad representation, at least mimicking what you would see in state government. We wanted to make sure that we were reaching out to other others and not just being very insular in our approach. So we tried contacting people through emails, directing them to our website, meeting with, in my case, the HR directors group to get the word out. And where we got the most interest is at the end when we actually had a town hall on rate setting. And that's when I guess people got the first opportunity to, again, have that experience, which I would call sticker shock. And we got a number of questions through that process that we were able to work through and hopefully explain to people. My CUB, and I was teasing Mr. Psyche earlier, that the HR side might be a little more touchy-feely, and we really wanted to figure out what could we do better for communication. So we worked with DAS to develop a survey to go out to all agency directors as well as HR directors and ask how could we better inform you along the way. And we were a little surprised by the results because one of the primary answers we got was more email, which is usually not the thing that you hear from people, that they want more email. But there were some nuggets from that we intend to use going forward. In our CUB meeting last week, we actually talked that a strategy might be to bring in budget folks from the agencies or people that represent the budget interest of the smaller boards and commissions earlier in the rate setting process so they could better be informed of the methodologies and maybe help us understand some of the intricacies of individual budgets and how that might impact the services overall.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson, for helping us understand this. As I've been listening to the description, I keep hearing about groups of people getting together, town halls, more email, talking about, you know, sort of groupthink about how we work this out. And I'm just guessing from your titles, you know, principal executives, HIJ, I'm just trying to figure out, is anybody keeping track of how much time is being spent within the CUBS asking all of these very highly paid agency people to come in and think through this? I mean, this has been going on for a long time at this point, and I see Mr. Jordan shaking his head, yes, so you don't need to respond, but I'd sure like to talk about this in terms of the expenditure of time and talent that's putting together all of this sort of new and improved DAS.
Yeah, Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I might not have done a good job describing that. We have on our board, I think there's 12 to 15 people that have been working. We meet once a month to start with. Now we're down to about every other month. The outreach I'm talking about is separate, and that's just to make sure that agencies, boards, or commissions are actually informed as to what the rates are in the service level to make sure we're meeting their needs. Because the goal is to make sure we're really clear so people aren't surprised when they see what service they're getting, what the level of expected performance is, and what the cost is.
I have a 101 question.
So what happens
when a smaller agency, a commission, decides that they don't want this help, but our CUBS see that they need the help? How do you... I mean, and maybe, Mr. Jordan, that's a question for you in the future, but how do we work through that?
That's kind of what that kind of gets back to what I was asking about the HR stuff versus...
Yeah. May I answer that from a former agency
head? Yeah, please, Senator.
You got a call from the head of DAS that said, you'll be doing this. You're the governor's person. Click. That was the end of the conversation.
Well, that's what I would assume, but I'm hearing this give and take between the CUBS and the... Potentially between the CUB and these small agencies.
Yeah, and Chair Smith, I'll let Mr. Jordan give the full description. I'll just tell you from my agency. There are some services we don't have a choice in, and nor would we choose to, like the electronic recruitment. It's nice to have that all run in one way, so we're very consistent in how we treat applicants. In terms of the iLearn system, again, that was a choice. We're not forced to join, but we looked at the cost of having people drive to get centralized training versus being able to push out training, the cost of actually buying a unit, program that we would have to run and manage versus tagging on to the state, and it was the economy of scale that pushed us probably 4 years ago. It made sense for us to join in that. So some of the services are, you know, discretionary, but you have to provide them somehow, and you do the cost-benefit analysis and what works best. Some of them are non-discretionary.
I was going to say, I have to believe in the end, Mr. Jordan, you have the muscle to say we're moving in a direction, and the agencies understand they're moving in that direction. Senator Johnson?
One other comment I would make is we're talking about executive agency stuff right now, or executive branch. I would love to perhaps see the legislature take a page out of this book. I don't know how many times I've sat through the same sexual harassment training that's brought to you live.
Oh, my God.
If we all had tapes and could take it home, correct to 100, and send it back as a certification that we'd watched it, how much time we would save. And
for me, it's the mandated reporter one.
Well,
oh
the reporter,
God.
I mean, you probably had that as a doctor 50 jillion times.
That would
so
be correct.
Just anybody out there listening in legislative land, we could maybe benefit from some of this.
Let's
continue.
That's all I really had to cover for the HR Cub. Unless there are questions for me, I'll turn it over to Mr. Psyche.
Sir.
Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Steiner here, and members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Deputy for Central Services for Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm also the Chair of the Enterprise Technology Services Customer Utility Board. That provides technology services to state agencies through the state data center. So what I've been kind of, Senator Johnson.
My first move is smile.
Just smile, Betsy.
Yeah. But I walked into it with eyes wide open because I've actually been engaged in some way or another with the state data center since it was stood up in 2006. And one of the things we always struggled with over the years is how to set rates for the state data center. We'd set a rate, and typically when you think about a rate-based system, what you get billed is based on how much of the service you use. Mm-hmm. So it would stand to reason that if you reduce the amount of service you used, your billing should go down. If you increased, your billing should go up. But because of the rate-setting model at the state data center, if an agency reduced its use and that agency was billed less, in order for the data center to balance their budget, they have to increase the bill to another agency. So it was almost like that old analogy of squeezing the balloon. If you squeeze the balloon in one place, it popped out somewhere else. And so one of the charges that was given to the Cub by Mr. Jordan was to really kind of take a look at that and try to figure out why that dynamic was happening and was there a way to address it, so the rates would make a lot more sense on a go-forward basis. So after studying it, what we found is that the rate was really a mix of fixed costs and variable costs. And so if you reduce the rate, you still have to recover the fixed part of that rate somehow and somewhere. The Cub, there are 11 agency representatives on the Cub, and we had all been on the back end or receiving end of that dynamic. And this was something that was a high priority for us to try to come to some kind of a resolution or a new model. So what we decided to do is break out the fixed costs, things like rent and to some extent personal services, and really develop a model to assess those costs out to the agencies. And then the variable costs actually were truly variable, and so you could impact how much you were billed by reducing or increasing the rate of your use. And one of the things that I think we have to be very careful about is, and something that CUB members have to do is kind of take off their agency hat and really put on the enterprise hat and really look at things from the enterprise level and not really think about how a particular action is going to impact your specific agency. So what we did is we actually developed the methodology without doing any modeling on what the impact would be on an individual agencies. We just set the methodology and then ran some modeling on what the impact would be. And it was interesting because of the 11 CUB members, five of the agencies had their rate go up, five of the agencies had their rate go down, and one agency pretty much stayed at the same rate. So what I wanted to share with the committee was that in all the years I've been involved in state government, I would submit to you that this was one of the more transparent processes as far as a DAS rate setting exercise. And when we shared with, one of the things is when we shared information with agencies, not all agencies liked the result of the information, but they all appreciated the fact that they were actually getting an explanation of how the rate was set and then how they could impact the amount that was going to be billed to them based on their usage. And so that's kind of what I wanted to share with you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Psyche, thank you. How did the fact that we missed the calculation for the costs of standing up the data center factor into this rumination about fixed and variable costs? I was around when we stood up the data center, and I recall that we missed the estimate of the cost and overestimated the savings grotesquely. And that resulted in a huge whack to agencies right. that I don't recall a lot of dialogue about their willingness to participate. So help me understand your methodology against the reality of the fact that we frequently don't budget some of these savings very accurately.
So Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, like you, I've been through kind of the, what I would call the data center wars. And I think a lot of promises were made that were never delivered on. From the agency perspective, we didn't have a lot of say on what the business case was around the data center. And so basically as an agency, we were told this is what the rate's going to be and what your bill's going to be, and you need to find a way.
You're talking about ODOT because they got hit especially hard.
And at that point in time, I was with the Department of Human Services, which also got hit substantially. What I'm encouraged about is now we're kind of moving past that dynamic. And one other thing I'll share with the committee is we had a lot of discussion around the CUB on, so the data center business model is 9 years old. And we've never really taken a step back and said, so based on the business, the model is based on a business case that's 9 years old. Is this still the right model to deliver IT services to the state of Oregon? You know, are we doing the right things? Are we charging the right amount? Are we the most delivering the service effectively and efficiently? And so from that discussion, and Mr. Jordan, I think we'll be talking to you about this later, the state CIO, Mr. Pettit, is undergoing an assessment of the data center now and really taking a look at the business model. And I think that's something that's long overdue. And we'll probably be back before this committee or some other committee to share the findings of that study. And from that, I believe we will probably be looking at a different business model as we move forward on how we deliver IT services.
That's helpful to know. Thanks.
Senator Witzig.
Thank you. Mr. Sickey, also on the OWIN project, that's another one of the debacles, obviously. You have been part of ODOT and also of the CUB that looks oversees that. Has your group dissected what went wrong there as to not so much as a punitive thing, but as a learning opportunity to decide you're never going to do that again?
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Senator Whitsett, there have been, I think, numerous bodies that have looked into the whole OWIN project and how that was stood up. That really, looking at individual projects is not really one of the responsibilities that's been assigned to the customer utility boards. I think Mr. Jordan had a list of about 9 things that fall under the purview of the board. And so we really, as a board, haven't spent a lot of time on individual projects.
They can follow up, though. So a study of what has gone wrong in the past is not relevant to what we're going to do in the future.
Chair Smith and Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I that's not what I said. I just said that there were other people who were charged with the responsibility of dissecting that, and that wasn't within our purview.
Thank you.
All righty. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Jordan comes up, for the benefit of our new colleagues, OWIN is the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. That is a whole story in and of itself. It was to have first responders all capable of communicating with each other at the scene of a conflagration, for example. And it's a too long a story for now, but that's what the acronym stands for.
It was renamed the State Radio Project as it was transferred.
Yeah, as we frequently do. The state radio, that data center started off with a different name, too. So,
Senator Whitsitt, you had a question?
I do. I want to return to Mr. Representative Hurd's line of questioning. We kind of talked yesterday, and we waltzed around the room once. We generally describe economic growth and health of an economy relative to gross domestic product. So to what extent has this new GPI been included in DAS policy and budgeting decisions during your tenure? And can you describe how that metric intersects with GDP?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, we have not used the GPI to this point. It is still under development. We just finished what we call 2.0 version of the 10-year plan, which included a number of aspects, but one of the major pieces of work with that was to develop metrics for the different policy areas and outcomes and strategies in the plan. So we now have those. Those are online for anybody to see, and there's a way to interact with them. It's pretty cool, actually. But one of the pieces still under development, actually, is the GPI piece. We didn't use it in the production of this budget.
Thank you.
Representative Hurd, you had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said we're not using it yet, so it's still under development, I guess. So in 2013, the article I read last night said Ms. Hayes submitted a proposal detailing the need for $125,000 to launch the program and listed the Oregon GPI team, McGuire, DeMos, the entity that paid her $25,000 to promote the plan, and EcoTrust. So my question is the $125,000 taxpayer money? Is there more that's being spent, and where is that in the budget, proposed budget?
Mr. Chairman?
What I would ask on this is that part that's relevant to the budget I'd ask you to address, and then colleagues, I'd remind that we are a subcommittee of Ways and Means. So that portion that you feel comfortable
with. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hurd, there is nothing in that question that represents the budget.
Thank you. Let's continue.
I'm going to pick up discussing Enterprise Human Resource Services. We've got about 30 minutes left with your questions, so we're going to try and pick up the pace as we can on some of these. Ms. Nelson, I think, actually gave you a fairly good description of what this service provides. It's two sections, really: direct HR client services to mostly small agencies, boards and commissions, and then the systems that most agencies can depend on to do their HR work. The e-recruit system, the iLearn training system, and then the personnel and position database. The benefits to customers are pretty clear and consistent. You'll see along most of our service divisions. By providing a service, we allow agencies to focus on their core business program and not devote resources or as many resources to the HR service. By having a group of HR professionals who work with multiple agencies and multiple issues, you develop a diverse work skill and skill set and experience level that you might not have in a single HR representative in a small agency. So client agencies are able to access that benefit. We're able to provide those economically in the rate setting as Ms. Nelson described. This is a quick picture of the clients, the current clients of EHRS. There are about 20 of them right now. The average FTE is 30. We have one client we didn't list on this graph, and that's DAS. EHRS provides HR services to DAS, the agency. But if we put our agency on the graph, the scale of FTE would make it look really bizarre. So this is sort of the rough scale. And you'll see it is, again, average FTE of about 30 and mostly small agencies, boards, and commissions.
Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm just looking at the anomalous high spikes, the Oregon Educators Investment Board. That's a relatively sophisticated shop. And what I'm trying to figure out is what's the rationale for them to come to DAS for HR services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think the rationale was they're also a relatively new shop. And rather than bring on their own HR expertise, they found it just as easy to contract with us directly.
Okay.
Moving on to some budget drivers, unlike some of the other service divisions that you'll hear about in today and tomorrow, EHRS is solely based on charges for service. So it's a usage-based charge, whereas other, as Mr. Psyche was mentioning with ETS, there's an assessment level and then there's a charge for service. So you either buy full HR services from us or we offer sort of one-off ad hoc support if an agency has a HR shop, but they're swamped with other work and they need to recruit a position, they can come to us to do recruitment. Or if they want some help on an investigation, we can provide that on an as-needed basis and not provide the full suite of HR services. The CUB, as you see, made the rates. I would just give an example. So right now, the rate for HR services is $99 per FTE per month. And if you take an example of an agency with an average size of 28 FTE, so close to our average customer size, based on that rate, a biennial cost is $71,000. You can compare that to hiring a full-time equivalent HR rep in, you know, the $100,000 to $200,000 range. So you can see that through that economy of scale, there is real savings. It also, some agencies don't need full-time HR assistance, and so they're able to get service when they need it without having to hire a full-time staff person. Oops. A couple of the factors that are driving some of our work. Employment issues are getting increasingly complex. There are more federal regulations, more state regulations, changes to family leave laws. The Affordable Care Act has implications we discussed yesterday. So all of those make some of the work more complex. We've talked about the retirement level of our workforce. Planning for that is important. And the limitations of our HR systems in providing the data we need to appropriately do some of that planning. And then this fourth bullet about budget reductions and layoffs, as agencies have constricted their budgets, that's increased the work for HR in some cases, but not always. Going forward, EHRS's plan is to continue to work towards being a good strategic business partner. Mr. Chair, you asked how agencies might refer to DAS, and we said service provider. We also would like them to refer to us as strategic partners in this work, mm-hmm. and that's the goal of this work. We also know from the Hackett study, I think I mentioned yesterday, that there was a recommendation in there that this sort of centralized HR service is a good model and could be expanded. And so we are looking to see if we could create the capacity to be able to absorb additional clients, and we are in some discussions.
And I would share with our new members, if you get an opportunity, get a copy of the Hackett report, the Hackett study. It was bold of the Department of Administrative Services to bring that forward, because there are a lot of critical points that were mentioned in there, and you don't see directors normally bringing those forward, and so you really are to be commended for bringing that to us. So I would encourage your freshmen to take a look at that.
And if I may, Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I would echo everything you said, and also if the study itself isn't super clear, I am confident that Mr. Jordan, Mr. Pack, or others from DAS will be more than happy. It really was illuminating about places where our government is not at best practices and where we could be offering both better customer service and more efficient service to both our everyday Oregonians and other members of the government.
Yeah, my jaw dropped.
I was fascinated. We had, two full days of presentation on that last year, and it was really illuminating. I think it's a testament to your commitment to making government more efficient, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair. We're happy to provide both documentation, but also happy to meet and talk about those with any members.
Is it still up on your website?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is. It's also, I think, still up on OLIS.
Yeah.
If you go back to
the very early
presentation.
Days of the 2013 session.
Yeah, I think you can
couple
pull
of
it.
Days yeah. there.
Yeah.
We've got 23 minutes.
I'm going to try to blast through the next section, enterprise goods and services, and we'll see how we do. And we've got more days with you. Enterprise goods and services is the section that provides a lot of financial procurement risk, as you can see from the org chart. Risk management really is the group that insures people, property, and activities of state government. We are self-insured for property damage. We are self-insured for liability, general liability. We're also self-insured for workers' comp. We also buy a number of other insurances for different things. Our job is to advise agencies on risk, to do some training, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we can, and to the degree we can, prevent loss, not pay for loss. That's our job.
Senator Johnson?
I can think of one agency that was involved in a lawsuit that was essentially settled out. And settled out, I'm not so sure with the agency's complete acknowledgement that the fact scenario was correct. I'm trying to figure out what effect the risk management policies have on that agency now, or where there's a catastrophic loss. I'm really looking at two things. How do the mechanics of risk management work? Because it isn't reflective of like a traditional marketplace. And then the second thing is, when an agency can't, in effect, manage its own risk, maybe the agency wants to litigate, but that option is taken away from them because somebody decides for political reasons or whatever reasons it's a good thing to get it settled and done with. To what degree are the agencies your partners in dealing with those kinds of examples? Let's just take, for example, the $4 million paid out in the foster care situation, huge settlement. And I don't know anything more than what I just said about it, but that's going to be a big whack to the agency. How do you deal with that in calculating their exposure and concomitant expense to deal with risk management when they've got a settlement of that magnitude?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, our rates for risk are set based on experience for agencies. So there's a 3-year rolling experience average that we use. So let's take your example where an agency has a $4 million payout. We then start to calculate their rates to recover that over the next 3 years. So their rates, it's a smoothing process. But basically, that experience rating goes into their rate making, and the costs are ultimately recovered.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. But you said an interesting thing. The rates are set based on the recovery.
Based on experience of the agency. So if you have experience where you have lots of big payouts,
right.
Your rates are going to be very high.
I understand that, but you said you would smooth the rates until recovery was achieved. So you're really trying to pay the program back, the $4 million?
Indeed.
Okay.
Because it comes out of one pot, Senator.
And how much was the risk management division of DAS involved? I mean, were you fully apprised of the fact that that looked like it was where it was moving through the adjudicatory process?
We're very involved. So when a claim comes in, lawsuits filed, tort claim notice, et cetera, we have a relationship with the Department of Justice. We evaluate the claim, try to say, how valid is it? Is there any kind of issue here? Should we be settling this claim right away? Should we be entering into the legal process? Do we move to depositions? When we get through depositions, how do our chances at trial look if we get that far? Quite frankly, we settle the vast majority of our claims before we get into the legal system, or we simply dismiss them because they're not valid. So either way, we don't get into the legal system. When we do go to court, we most of the time win. On occasion, we don't. So there are judgments made. The agency is involved in those judgments at least apprised, and we work with them regarding certainly the fact set. What's the fact set of the particular claim? But ultimately, it's the risk fund and the state of Oregon that is on the line for the liability. And so ultimately, that decision is made at DAS with legal advice.
Just obviously. A point of clarification. Yeah. I was talking about the first case I started discussing was the Department of Aviation.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then I switched. And okay. The facts remain, I think, controversial in that one.
Well, the process, however, is very much the same with every agency, regardless okay. of the claim.
You. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Jordan, the risk management recently made some pretty significant policy changes created without making any administrative rules. To extend the defense of civil tort claims to defense of certain criminal charges. Can you explain what went on there? That seems to be a kind of a quantum leap in what risk management does.
We've actually had that Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, we've had that policy for, I want to say, scores of years. It's never been used prior to this last year. We have a process in the policy that we go through. The agency submits a request for coverage of an individual. There is a committee that meets made up of risk management, myself. I'm trying to remember who else, Department of Justice. I think the governor's office is represented on that committee. We only met a couple of times, so I can't remember all the people. But it's in the policy that committee meets. That committee has the sole discretion to decide whether to represent or not represent that individual. I should say pay for the representation. Those individuals actually get their, at least in this case, got their own counsel. And we agreed to pay for that. Now, there's a limitation on the pay. It's, I believe, $35,000. I can't remember exactly. But also, there's a limitation if the case moves and the person moves from the status of witness to the status of target of an investigation, there's a limitation on our paying if the nature of the case changes. So that's the policy we have. And that policy has been around. We did make some changes to put limitations. Those limitations are new, though they weren't in the policy before.
Thank you for that clarification. Could you make that available to the committee, that policy, please?
Certainly. Thank
you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
So before we proceed, I have a 101 question.
Uh-oh.
So we have a risk fund. And maybe the rest of the committee knows this, and
no,
I should.
Okay.
We have a risk fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's being seeded. It's being funded.
Yes.
How do we determine the appropriate level of funding right. on a biennial basis to put into the risk fund? How are we determining that?
We have an actuarial analysis done of the fund every 2 years. That actuarial analysis takes into account not only claims we've already received, but potential claims that we haven't received yet. Okay. And I'll get into the actual levels if I get there
okay,
today.
Thank you.
So, second to risk is procurement services, responsible obviously for establishing statewide price agreements. We have 636 local governments and nonprofits that actually are members of what we call the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program. They can take part in the statewide price agreements and purchase off of those. We also do large procurements for agencies when they need help. We do what we call, there are designated procurement officers in many agencies. We do training for them, keep them up to speed, and we must allow an agency to do their own procurement, and they need to have that level of expertise when we do that. Shared financial services, basic, very straightforward. We supply accounting, accounts payable, accounts receivable, budgeting services for client agencies. There are about 30 client agencies for shared financial services.
So when we have accounts receivable,
mm-hmm.
and we have owings to the state, maybe not right now, share with it because we don't have time, but I'd be interested in knowing the relation. How are we coordinating with the Department of Revenue on those folks who owe us money, and you folks are assisting in that collection process and utilizing the muscle of the Department of Revenue in their collection? tools as well. Is there any coordination?
Mr. Chairman, there is coordination. However, there isn't enough. And we have a project working out of our shop right now with all of the agencies, well, all, the largest agencies that have accounts receivables. Senator Witz and I have talked about this issue in the past. And we have a project to coordinate that. And I believe there is actually legislation this session to establish what I would say a more cohesive system regarding accounts receivables.
Thank you.
We also have a group that's called Financial Business Systems. These are the folks that take care of the statewide accounting and payroll systems and assist agencies in the use of those systems. They also reconcile PERS data. We have a significant amount of retirements, obviously, and we have to do PERS reconciliations, and I'll get to that in a little bit. We have 39 client agencies in Financial Business Systems, and then publishing and distribution. They provide secure printing and distribution services to state and some county governments. Actually, the majority of county governments utilize us. A tangible example of that is that P&D prints and distributes all legislative bills during your session. We also print and mail a large number of property tax statements for counties. So what are some of the drivers and factors in enterprise goods and services? One is obvious. The more agencies that want our service, the more we need to be able to supply those. The demand for service is going up among not only agencies, but outside of state government, the utilization of some of our services.
Can you give me an example of why we would allow an agency not to utilize DAS payroll? Why would they do their own?
All agencies have the central payroll system.
Okay.
Agencies, however, some agencies, usually the larger ones, but many agencies have their own process of timekeeping, preparing payroll to be processed by DAS. And so there are different timekeeping systems, front-end systems to payroll that exist in agencies.
That makes sense. Thank you.
You bet. Some of the other drivers for us, biannually, there are changes in collective bargaining agreements. We have 30-plus collective bargaining agreements at the state of Oregon. All of them have nuanced aspects to them that end up having to be changes to the payroll system whenever any of those aspects are renegotiated in collective bargaining, from premium time to rates for health care, et cetera, have to be changed. Also, the state and federal regulations regarding wage and hour law are changing constantly, and we need to react to those. In conjunction with that, the age and functionality of our accounting and payroll system is another one of those things that Mr. Pack was listing on our core systems, and we'll talk a little bit about the replacement of those, but they are very cumbersome systems and take a lot of support. And then lastly, the two which go to risk, there are real trends in risk in tort claim law that are driving a change in the dynamic around litigation. The tort claim limits have risen over the last few years. It is driving a very different dynamic with plaintiff attorneys and the level of stick-to-itiveness they have in a case, because the potential payoff at the end is much higher. And so it's changed the dynamic about negotiating. It's also changed the level of engagement with the Department of Justice on our side of those dynamics in claims. So that's a driver regarding some of our costs. Keep moving. P&D, publishing and distribution. Just a couple of facts about them. I wanted to note one thing. We do some things with local governments. A good example of that is the city of Eugene is just now beginning to shut down their publishing department. And we are working with them to take over some of their larger jobs. So, for instance, we published and mailed a survey that they wanted to do with their citizens just recently. We're making a proposal to them to produce jury summons on the template that we use that we developed for county district courts. So that's coming along. Some of the advantages of using P&D, a first class postage stamp's 49 cents. The pre-sort rate for us, if we take that mail and move it around within our system, is 38.1 cents. It's per piece. We're currently, as I mentioned, printing jail summons for 30 different counties. We do property tax statements and the mailing for 20 different counties. One of the other things that people don't realize, I think, is that P&D acts as a broker for agencies also. We don't just supply service when they ask. We also, if they ask for a certain kind of job that we know the private sector can supply more efficiently and faster, we broker that service and find that vendor for them rather than them having their own people in multiple agencies looking for the best deal. We know the industry, and so we broker those services. So moving on to procurement, you can see here on the slide, this is a representation of some of the value of the statewide price agreements. I think, yes it is.
It says value now.
Okay. Huh. There's about $500 million in the 13-15 biennium so far that's gone through the statewide price agreements. Just on not doing your own RFI, RFP, bidding, whatever process you happen to be using and be able to buy off the statewide price agreement, we believe in our calculations there's about a 3% discount on cost of everything if you can just go to the statewide price agreement, let alone the price you get because of the volume we use on price agreements. That's just in processing. Also, as I mentioned earlier on the cooperative procurement program, there are about 636 active members of that. That includes school districts, colleges, universities, cities, counties, special districts, and nonprofits. We have some market share that we could gain still. There are about 1,500 plus of those kinds of entities, not counting nonprofits. Those are just governmental entities in Oregon. So we've got some room to grow there. I'd just like to note that you can see the list of folks who are major sellers on those statewide price agreements, and they run the gamut from automobiles to technology systems to office paper.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. You know, looking at this slide, Mr. Jordan, and thinking about what you just said about the role of the agency in serving as a broker, makes me wonder how you identify those businesses and what you do to specifically look for smaller businesses, minority women, emerging small businesses, especially because in parts of the state that's all there are. We want, and we certainly have a priority for supporting small business development.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, Chair Steiner-Hayward, the processes we use to actually get vendors are the same processes we use in a regular procurement. We simply usually do broad procurements for a certain kind of vendor. Mm-hmm. We score those the way we would normally. If it's a procurement that, and we have a way of looking for MWSBs in those procurements, just as we would in a straight regular procurement. So what I will say is the process is generally the same, but once we've made those determinations that here's a set of vendors that can meet the state's needs, then we're allowed to use them on a work order basis, basically, okay, rather than procure each time.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Senator Steiner-Hayward, we also have procurement staff whose part of their job is to go around the state helping identify businesses and educate them on the process of how to contract or how to
Thank
bid.
You.
And,
yes.
Good. And we target small businesses and women-owned and minority-owned businesses
and,
as
and
well.
And let me add a third-party endorsement, folks. They do a phenomenal job in their outreach.
Great, because I was
Kelly
concerned
Stevens
about that.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. She's the best.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Please send my best to the board. We appreciate what she's done for Eastern Oregon. Senator Johnson?
I guess I was just trying to understand, DAS, when this is the procurement side, on the divestiture side where you're helping agencies get rid of equipment, mm-hmm. Do you still pick up a rather sizable percentage of the divestiture if you provide that service? Is it a fixed percentage or is that negotiable? I can think of a certain train set that got sold.
I'll let Barry do this one.
Oh, great. Now that you've got a specific example, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the rate is changing from the prior biennium to what's proposed in the budget this biennium. And it depends upon whether it's a vehicle sale or non-vehicle sale. But there is a portion of each of the proceeds essentially that come in from the sale that DAS keeps. There is a cap, a $2,000 cap on any proceed, I guess. I'm not sure that's the charge.
The charge we have.
The charge we have. And
regardless of the value of the underlying asset?
Even if it's very
high. So there's a flat fee that any charge, there's a flat charge that gets charged for any thing that gets sold. And then based on the value of that thing, there's a percentage increase that DAS retains, but then there's a cap.
Got it. Minimum charge, sliding scale on value, capped at $2,000. So if the value...
For the totality of the transaction. I don't recall if you were at DAS at the time when we were divesting ourselves of some Bud cars, rail cars, and I was dumbstruck when the goal here was to try to refill the general fund that had been extended to run that operation and pay it off in its entirety, to see that at one point DAS was in for a 25% take on what was a $1 million transaction, if I recall that correctly. We negotiated that away because it was anomalous. You don't sell train sets every day. But I'm just trying to figure out. So $1 million Bud car, your total take after you do all this calculation is only $2,000.
We believe
that. I would like to double check that because the rates are changing and I want to make sure that I'm not confusing myself more than I confused you. So let's get back to
you. You've done a great job of confusing me. So thank you.
We'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
So I'm going to skip the next slide because I think it's out of sequence. I'd like to go to this one and talk a little bit more about risk.
Let's do this. We have 3 minutes.
We can come back? I can finish this slide.
This is really important, Mr. Chair. I'd like to come back to this if you don't mind.
Sure.
Would that be all right? Madam Co-Chair, are you okay with that?
Totally fine. And just as a reminder, colleagues, tomorrow we'll have a work session first thing. So please be on time. We're going to limit that work session to no more than 20, 25 minutes because we really will be, as Co-Chair Smith pointed out today on some other questions, focusing exclusively on budget ramifications of the policy bill. And then we'll return to the presentation from Mr. Jordan and Mr. Pack. Yeah. And we thank you, gentlemen, for your flexibility.
Representative Hurd, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, Mr. Jordan, I wasn't satisfied with the last response. I think this directly pertains to the budget. My question was, is DAS still planning on spending taxpayer money on the GPI system?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hurd, we're still working on GPI. So it's a tool within Chief Financial Office where we do budget projections and scenario analysis for the governor in the preparation of his budget. So we are still developing the tool to work on that. It's used in conjunction with the other metrics that are in the 10-year plan as we work with the governor through different policy and budget options. To your previous question specifically, the email you're referring to was for an application to foundations to fund work on GPI. It was not an application to state government. We in no way were involved in anything around that. So that was the reference in the email you're specifically referring to.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions? All right, we have 1 minute. You want to wrap up or you're wrapped
up? I'm wrapped.
You're wrapped up. All right.
With a bow.
Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Co-Chair, I wonder if internally they refer to this as EGS, Enterprise Goods and Services.
EGS.
No, Representative Nathan. No, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I'd like to go back to one other thing that we talked about, and that was this policy that you're going to bring us about the state providing defense costs on criminal cases. How often is that used?
To my knowledge, Senator, it's never been used before the Cover Oregon issues. It's been on the books for a long time, and as Senator Whitsitt noted, we amended that policy before we used it this time because we realized it didn't have limits in it. So we put dollar limits and some limits regarding the nature of the defense. And so it really was to provide representation for people who were under subpoena in an investigation. In this case, it happened to be a criminal investigation.
And follow up?
Please.
And at this moment, does that capping policy, is that prospective, or did that reach back to the cases in Cover Oregon that were being covered? Are those open-ended, or are they subject to your caps?
The cap applies. It was imposed before we utilized the policy.
Thank you.
And then I guess the last thought I would leave with is, I'm still very interested in our conversation yesterday on assessments and what assessments the department has and how those are calculated. And so I'm hoping at some point we'll be able to address that. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I let Mr. Siebert know that we are working on getting you good information that's understandable rather than spreadsheets galore.
And Mr. Chair, I suggested that we might even set some time aside next week early for them to go over it rather than just, you know, give it to you as an attachment.
I think that would actually be very helpful. Okay, we would appreciate that very much.
All right. Seeing no other business before us. Paul, are we good? Good, Julie? All right. We are going to adjourn. Good, Julie? All right. We are going to adjourn.